Okay, so welcome everybody. My name is Ken McIntosh, I'm the presiding officer, but in today's context I'm also chair of the Parliament's Futures Forum, and this seminar is part of a series we're looking at health and fitness, and particularly what people like Shelley can show us in terms of leading the way, their expertise in sport, what they can show us in a political context to make this a healthier nation. As I'm sure you know, our rising obesity levels are deeply worrying, and it's very important that as a country, not just as individuals, but as a country, that we keep ourselves fit and healthy. And clearly sport in particular has a particular role to play in that. We should also attribute SPICE. So this is a session not organised just by the Futures Forum, but also by the Scottish Parliamentary Information Centre. So thank you to SPICE for their input. But can I welcome our guest, Shelley Kerr. Thank you very much, Shelley, for coming along. This is a fantastic experience for all of us. I'm particularly conscious that it's a month to go tomorrow.
32 days until we play England.
Countdown to the World Cup. And obviously the Scotland football team is riding in a high. So I'm really delighted, and your success has been noted by all of us. And it's fantastic for you to come along today and share some of that experience and what you've learned. Just to introduce you properly, Shelley Kerr won every domestic honour in Scottish football, as well as 59 caps for her country. As a manager, she has coached the women's under-19 national team. She's led Arsenal to an FA and Continental Cup double, and was the first female manager of a senior men's football team when she was appointed manager of Stirling University in 2014. In 2017, Shelley became head coach of the Scottish women's national team. And as you all know, under her management, we have qualified for the World Cup in France starting in June. And with such experience in global sport that continues to grow in popularity, that World Cup, I think, will be hugely popular here in Scotland. I certainly hope so. Shelley's in a great place to share her experience and her thoughts on what we can learn from sport. So, Shelley, I'm going to hand over to you, and I think you're going to start with a presentation.
Yep. Well, firstly, it's a real pleasure and an honour to be here to speak to you guys today. I think normally when I'm sitting in front of an audience, it's usually letting players down or making them the happiest people in the planet. So what I plan to do today is firstly do a quick introduction and show you a short video, and then I'm going to present for about 15 minutes, and then I'm going to open the floor to questions. So you have to bear with me because I'm going to share a bit of my journey. So it stems back, I'm approaching my 50th year this year. I know that's quite hard to imagine. That was supposed to be a joke. but I'm going to share my journey and where it all started for me. And hopefully you can take some of the learnings from my journey and some of the challenges that I've faced along the way. So I'm going to start with a short video. So I'm going to try and take you back to where it all started. So you can see, if you can see here, there's a little pyramid of my performance journey. And I want to just touch base because I think this is important, both professionally and personally. It takes a long time to develop yourself in any walk of life. And you can see in the left-hand side of the pyramid, well, hopefully you can. Is there a little laser at all? No? This one? Okay, doesn't matter. So on the left-hand side, you'll see a column, and it's got 0 to 5, 5 to 10. That's years. So I'm going to start at the bottom, where it all started. So as you can see from the video, from about 3-4 years old, I started kicking a ball. And that's going back now 46, 47 years ago. And it was a time where, not just in football, but in sport in general, that, you know, it wasn't deemed the right thing to do, especially a little girl playing football, which was predominantly classed as a male sport. And I had two older brothers and an older sister who encouraged me to play sport. So my passion was football, and that's where it all started. I played in my local village, a little village in West Lothian, Polbeth, and I played alongside the boys. And there'll be a little recurring theme and a pattern here to everything that I tell you. But right away, there's a stigma attached when you're a girl playing football. And probably at the time I didn't realise it, but this started to build my character as a person and as an individual as early on as 3, 4, 5 years old. So I went to Polbeth in West Calder Community, so Parkhead Primary and West Calder High School. The 5 to 10 years was developing the skills, coordination, balance, again, learning to play alongside the boys and playing a sport that at that time, girls and women's football didn't have any formal infrastructure. I played with the boys. I first got selected to play for my primary team. I was the only girl to play for my primary team. And thanks to my art teacher, Mr. Wilkinson, who saw me play in the playground with ripped tights and muddy shoes, he invited me along for a trial. And that's where really it all started for me, the first time playing organised football. And it was tough because, again, there was a stigma attached. So when you would turn up to play, that's a girl, why is she playing football? And it probably, way back then, put a lot of females off sport in general, and especially team sport. And I'll touch base on that a wee bit further into the presentation. But that's where I developed my technique. So I played in the playground, played on the pitch, developed our own games. In the local village, in fact, our local pitch, we had to make the goals diagonal so that we could make it bigger for having 20 a side. It's typical as many people from my era grew up, and it was great. I then, when I went to high school, it was a huge thing for me because I got told that I could no longer play football. So as a young kid, brilliant to play for my primary team, and when I went to secondary school, they said, you can't play with the boys anymore. You're not allowed to play with the boys. So I was devastated. And, you know, I pleaded with my mum because it was all I was ever interested in life was playing football. So my mum wrote a letter to my PE teachers, and she asked when the girls took dancing, could I take part in football? And thankfully, my PE teachers agreed to that. So during the curriculum and school PE curriculum, I was able to go and take part. But I just couldn't play for a team. So back then, there was two leagues. It's quite hard to imagine that now where we're in a position, women's football, we've probably got just under 12,000 registered players. There was probably about 200. So the game has evolved massively. But that time, as a 13-year-old, there was no youth football for me to play in. Couldn't play with boys. And I ended up playing for a women's team at 13 years old. So I was playing against women twice my age. I spent 2 years running up and down the touchline, not getting on the pitch. But I was so dedicated and determined that I thought I would get my chance eventually. And all that was in my head at that time was not negativity or disappointment. It was, how can I learn from some of these senior women players who some were at that point playing national team football? So I developed a lot of core fundamental skills, life skills as well, from an early age. Played for the women's team, and I eventually, fast forward a little bit, when I was 18 years old, I got my first cap for Scotland. So it was 1989, ironically, against England. I came on as a second half substitution. And at that point, I had to pay £50 for playing for my country. So to represent my country, I stayed in the hotel overnight. We played England. And the substitutes, which I was one of, they didn't have a tracksuit for every sub. So I think I had the top on and someone else had the bottoms on. So again, there's going to be a recurring theme here. But the reason I want to share this with you is because, again, I think it's been important for me in terms of where I'm at now, because I've experienced absolutely everything the good times, the bad times, the hard times, and so on. I left school with no formal qualifications. It was a tough time. I was the youngest of the four in the family, and if you got a, it was the era of the YTS schemes, and there's a lot of people nodding their head here. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, £27.50 you got for working a week. So I was really fortunate. I was one of the lucky ones. There was an electronics company called Mitsubishi Electric who made VCRs. I'm sure there's a lot of people in this room that can't remember VCRs, so I'm being kind to you. But I was really fortunate. I got a full-time job. So I left school, no qualifications, and this was brilliant because... You were able, in comparison with a YTS scheme at the time, just to let you know, the younger ones in the audience here, £27.50 as opposed to £71. So it was a huge difference. And my family were delighted because it was a full-time job, which was a struggle at that point in time. You're talking 1985, 1986. And I have to be honest, in everything that I've done in my career, Mitsubishi Electric, working a factory, a high volume production line, was one of the best things that I've ever done. I started off as a production operator, and when I finished 17 years later, I was a manager responsible for three production lines and 90 employees. Because of technology, the workforce became redundant, so the factory closed, and it was a new chapter for me. Working for a Japanese company taught me many, many things. Discipline, organisation, to be efficient, to be effective, and to manage people. That was a huge thing. You had a red and a black every day. If you didn't meet your targets, people got sacked. And I'm not saying for one second that's the right way to do things. But what it did do was give you a discipline, work ethic, an experience of managing tough, tough situations. Doesn't matter if that's sport, doesn't matter if it's business, you're managing people and dealing with human emotions. So it was huge for me. Going back to football, I had experience playing for the national team. I knew that I had a passion. I would consider myself as a player. I wasn't the most gifted or talented, but I was hardworking. I had really good game awareness, and I always knew I wanted to be a coach because I wanted to help people, wanted to help educate people. So I started to go through the coach education pathway, but in the meantime, I took a break from football to have my daughter. So I had 8 years out. I got my first cap in 1989, and I got my second one in 2001. There's a lot of intelligent people in this room, so you can work out the maths there. So to do that a second time after being out for so long was tough. I went back. I remember my coach at that time saying to me, you're not fit, don't look healthy. And I thought, well, I'm not playing at it. I've never played at anything in my life. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it well. So I took the bull by the horns, got myself fit, re-educated myself in many different ways, and started playing football again at a really, really good level. Went on to play for some big clubs, and never about the winning, but about the experiences that you get, playing alongside different people, coaching different people, and then subsequently taking a new pathway in life, which I'm sure a lot of people in this room do as well, or will do. I finished my stint at Mitsubishi Electric, and I know that I'm going backwards and forwards here, but please bear with me. I know I'm going off on a tangent, but it's all relevant. I got an opportunity to go into the Scottish FA in a part-time position, which I did. So never about financial remuneration. It was always about how can I develop myself to get all the skill set that I need to be successful in everything that I do. So I took a chance, went in, then the post got made redundant. I went to North Lanarkshire Council, worked as a football development officer. My first coaching experience was at Kirknewton Nursery School. And I can tell you, It was a terrible experience for me as a coach, and it probably was for the kids as well. I went into a room, smaller, much smaller than this. It was the dining room as well, and we had to do an activity with the kids. They were maybe about 3 or 4. We used balloons. The fire alarm went off. The kids were crying. And here's me now taking the Scottish Women's National Team to the World Cup. So way back then, it was part of the my learning process as a coach. But so again, I worked. This was really, really important part of my development, working as a development officer, because I started off at the very, very lowest end of the pathway. So a lot of people, when you get to the top end, think, well, that's quite fortunate that you're working with a national team. For me, it's extremely important that you have a real handle on everything to do with pathways, because then you have a real empathy and an understanding of what it takes to go through, because not everyone will reach the top level of their sport. That's a fact. There's a small, small minority. So it's really important for me to see the development plans of individuals coming through in their sport. I then went back into the Scottish FA. They must have thought that I'd done something right first time round. I was responsible for, I was a technical and programme development manager for women's football. So I basically looked at developing all the elite players in the pathway and devising curriculum. I was also the under-19s manager. Fast forward, Arsenal ladies. I got a big move down to London. Again, helped me equip myself dealing with players that were now playing in a professional environment, getting paid. My coach education. And again, this is extremely important and something I'm really proud about. I knew I wanted to work with senior adult players. In the coach education pathway, there's a children's pathway, youth and adult. I started at the very bottom. I worked my way through the children's, then the youth, and then the adults. And eventually, I got my UEFA Pro licence in 2013. At the top of this is 40 plus it's got. I vowed that when I deliver this presentation, I won't put 50 plus. I'm always going to leave it at 40 plus. But the whole point of the significance of that is that I've had 40 years studying football, which now I think that I'm not the finished article, but I do think I'm an expert in football because of the lengthy time that I've studied and all the different areas and capacities that I've worked in. And probably, besides having my daughter, probably one of the proudest things, and obviously getting to the World Cup, but I graduated in 2016 with a Master's in Sports Management after leaving the school in 1985-86 with no formal qualifications at all. So my pathway, my journey has been quite different, I would say. And there's been a lot of things that have been instrumental in terms of where I am now. So I wanted to share that with you because I think it's quite important. I had the challenges of the dropout years, which a lot of teenagers go through now, especially girls in sport. Mine's happened a wee bit later. I had 8 years out. Learning to train with boys, learning to play with boys, developing technique, then performing to win, having experienced everything goes into winning as opposed to developing. So I've had a whole host of different experiences in there, which has been quite important for me. I think this one's key. And if you look at this picture in the middle, some of you might think that my mother doesn't like me with that haircut. But the reason I wanted to share this was that this picture in the middle is of me as a 10-year-old. And without reading all the kind of narrative and the text there, I was a 10-year-old and I had a dream of playing for my country. And dreams do come true. They do. But it takes a lot of hard work. But I wanted to represent my country. And that's all I cared about. It was hard then. It was hard competing with the boys. And fast forward, all these years later, this was the headlines when I was appointed at Stirling University. football isn't just a man's game anymore. Breaking barriers. Shelley is brave to be a boss in the men's game. I would pose the question to everyone. Why? If you have a skill set and the competencies, gender goes to the side, and it should always go to the side. But there was a huge thing about my appointment at Stirling University, and a lot of media attention because it was the first in the UK. Personally, I didn't understand what all the fuss was about. But there was a lot of fuss. And the way I see it now is that I genuinely do think that there will be a female manager in the professional men's game at some point. And I really hope there is, because I think that there's so many female coaches and role models now that could do the job. And I think that in years to come, it should be a regular thing if they've got the competencies and the skill set. So I wanted to show you those pictures because it's something that, if you look at it, there's a picture 40 years ago and there's a picture more in the last few years. And it's very, very similar messages. So as much as things have evolved, I think there's still a long way to go in changing a perception, and especially when it comes to girls playing football, but also girls and women in sport. And I'll touch base on that when we look to the future, but I wanted to share that with you. Summarising my journey, looking at the secrets to success. Five simple things for me. Spirit and resilience. How do you develop that in yourself, the characteristics that you have? It's something that I would say that I have in abundance. I'm a fix-it person. If someone asks me to do something, I always say yes. Even if it's the most daunting things, I will say yes. Number two and three, being organised, disciplined and being efficient and effective. 17 years in a factory and the values that my parents instilled in me certainly epitomises those skills. And it's huge in any walk of life, not just sport. If you're organised and disciplined in life, then, you know, it stands yourself in good stead. Number four is increased professionalism. That comes down to the education that you get. It comes down to how you develop yourself as a person, how you develop leaders within a group that you work with. And it's something that I really pride myself on. We talk about in the national team right now, you know, how many leaders do you have? We want to develop 23 leaders, because when it comes to problem solving, which is what you have to do in sport, because there's so many variables, you need as many leaders as possible. So as much as they're talented on the pitch, we need to help them develop other characteristics. The final one is the team behind the team. There's so many people instrumental in terms of your own development, and that's everyone in this room. You know, you've got supporting family members, you've got a support mechanism of friends around you, you've got mentors. Some of you probably don't even know, or people outside don't know that you've got mentors. It's using the experiences of other people to help you. And I always talk about the team behind the team. You're never the finished article as an individual. You need people to support you, and that's so, so important. In terms of my vision for women's football, we have been successful to date, qualifying for two major tournaments, so the Euros in 2017 and obviously the World Cup. And I think that in women's sport now, because it's taken us so long to get the profile that we deserve, I think that there's been probably a challenge in terms of having that critical reflection. And to get better at anything, you need to critique. So that's what we've done in the Girls and Women's Game of Scotland. We've done a full audit and we thought, where do we want to be? How do we sustain the success? So you'll see in the bottom corner there, this is our Girls and Women's Performance Strategy. And it's a twofold document which incorporates a football blueprint, but it also looks at Girls and Women's Football from a strategic point of view. So that's looking at infrastructure, it's looking at performance, and then it's looking at how we can grow the game. So that document and everything that's in it is getting rolled out to all the six regions in the country just now. And as I say, it's an evolving document that we will look at constantly to see how we can get the best out of women's football in Scotland. There's key objectives. Big one from a performance perspective is that we want to get to every final. So we operate in cycles and competitions, so it's always Euros, World Cup. We want to now set ourselves a target that every single time there's a Euros and a World Cup that we want to get to the finals. I'm not guaranteeing that that's going to happen, but so far it's been okay. We want to provide a clear and progressive pathway, especially when it comes to performance into the women's national team. So that's looking at all the youth teams. Again, I've mentioned critical evaluation and reflection. We need to be proactive in identifying the world stage and the European stage and who are the best teams, who are the best players. And the last thing for us, is, and it's hugely important, is in Scotland, how do we professionalise the game? And I think that's a word that people misinterpret at times. People think when you talk about being professional, it's about getting paid to do something. And it's not the case. It's about taking a professional approach. So that's something that obviously we are really looking at in terms of our domestic game in Scotland. As you're probably aware, the majority of our players are playing out with Scotland. We've got a duty to make sure that our domestic product is good as well and we get resource into our domestic league in Scotland. How do we make the World Cup a platform for success? There's two parts to this. There's a performance side. So the target is to get out the group stages. We know it's going to be tough, but that is our target. And we'll readdress that target if and when we get out the group. The second part is we're going to the World Cup for the very first time. To ensure that it happens again, we need to make sure that we grow the game. So what does that look like? We're looking at supporting our best players in the country. Can we provide them a professional environment so that they can improve? Can we provide them with an environment so that they don't leave to go to other countries and play, so that we can get a better product domestically? Can we offer scholarships? At the moment in our pathway, we have under 15s, 16s, 17s, 19s and then A squad. It's too big a gap. So we need a 21s, 23s team in there. We don't have the resource at this moment in time to do it. So there's a whole host of things here. But I think the biggest one for us is inspiring the country. As a national team, we've got a duty to captivate the nation. With the success comes more profile. There's more marketing comes. There's more sponsorship comes. And in turn, we hope that we can grow the game, because we don't want the last twice that we've qualified for major tournaments to be isolated cases. We need to make sure that we reinvest in the women's game. And that's a big thing for us. Myself as a national team coach, but the players as well. I know that they are real role models, but want to make a difference for the future. So it's hugely important for us. Moving forward, just my own personal views on the long-term future for women's participation in sport. If I flip back to when I was a young kid, you'll see the pictures on the right-hand side here. You've got Judy Murray, Catherine Granger, Elise Christie and Laura Muir. I know when I was a kid, I didn't get exposure to role models. This is huge. When I was putting this together, I could have picked numerous role models, female role models. And that is important for us. If we want to inspire young girls to get involved in sport, and this is not performance here, this is just participation, they need to have a good visual. They need to have role models that they can look up to. Whether they go on to play at a performance level or whether it's recreational, it's so, so important. And the more we see those role models, and we know the more we know their names, the better it is for our young kids from a physical health and wellbeing perspective. How can that happen? We need to build a system for women in sport. We need to look at resources. That's time, investment, expertise, information. We look at the enablers, the places, the people and the profile. And you look at environment, facilities, hugely important, building relationships and the programmes that we have for young kids and the pathways. They need to be really, really cohesive, and it's pathways that cater for everyone, not just the elite. Everyone starts off, even the players in the national team. I started off kicking a ball about in a park. That's where everyone starts. Whatever sport you do, you play the sport because you want to enjoy it and you want to have fun. So it's important that we get the right pathways and the right programmes in place so it caters for absolutely everyone. And we look at the outcomes. What do we have? No, everyone is going to be a top performer. So it's about education, qualifications, professionalism, and how do we retain people in the game? Who's our next physios, our next administrators, and so on and so on. There's so many opportunities within sport. Volunteers, how do we get more volunteers involved? And that is huge. And, you know, at the bottom there, you can see equalities and inclusion, people development, how do you develop people's skills? And, you know, a collaborative approach. I think that's huge. I was chatting before you guys came in, and I genuinely think that now we have a duty in the early years to make sure our kids are physically active. I think it's a huge problem. We're going to the World Cup, but if we're not careful in years to come, we're not going to have any team sports going to major tournaments. It's been 20 years since a football team's been at a World Cup. We need to ensure that we put the right resources in at the early years to develop the fundamental core skills for physical well-being. And that's from a health perspective. I genuinely see a big change in our kids and society, that our kids aren't as fit as what they were. And as a collective, I think we need to explore all the answers and put them in at an early age. That's for me personally, and even more so with females, because there's so many females drop out of sport. And talking from experience, being out football for 8 years was tough, and coming back, and we need to make it accessible and more accessible as much as we can. And that's me finished. Apologies for going off on a tangent. It's probably not the structure that you would normally have, but I was really keen on sharing certainly my journey, both from a professional perspective and personally. And I think that you need all those experiences in life, I think, to get to where you want to be, because it's never ever a smooth journey, and there's absolutely no doubt, and I don't expect to be in years to come a smooth journey either. I think there's lots of things in there that I've spoken about, so I'm really eager and keen to hear any questions you might have. But thanks for listening.